What I wanted to do is talk to you about cicadas. I've been getting a lot of calls, and it seems like a lot of people don't have a real sense about them. They know they're coming, but they haven't seen them before. Maybe they've heard the so-called annual cicadas, but haven't really seen one. So I wanted to give you some background and talk about a few things. I worked up a cheat sheet here that has a lot of the facts that I'll be talking about, so don't feel like you have to scribble furiously. But you'll have that there, and then I also just passed out a little paper that we'll kind of get to at the end of the talk if you're interested. So I want it to kind of be informal, even though I'm standing up in the front of the room with a microphone and there's a PowerPoint presentation. But the whole point of being here is for you to answer questions from or ask questions from whatever perspective you have that you might want to learn about these things, and I'll tell you what I can about them. So how many of you have seen periodical cicadas before? All right, okay, several. For those of you that haven't, here's some of them here, and you can pass this around. So these are adults up here at the top. Just that's the normal position that their wings are in. These are spread here, and then and I should say, these are just from our teaching collection, so some of them don't have any identification labels on them that students collect them and stick them in over the years. These two here are from Brood 2 from Ulster County, north of here, and they are the great-great-great-grandparents of the brood that's coming out now. So they're from collected in 1928. And then down here are some nymphal exoskeletons. This is what they shed after 16 and a half years. And then this one over here on the edge, it's not a periodical, but it shows an adult that was coming out that got stuck coming out. So molting the skin is a risky business. It's a necessary thing for arthropods, but it is really risky. And so pass these around if you want to take a look at them. And as I say, as I'm going through this, if you have a question, feel free to interrupt, either just blurt it out or stick up your hand and we'll talk about it. So here's a cicada, an adult, and a nymph down there. Yes, they're insects. They go through, I'll show you the life cycle in the next slide, but they're this way as a nymph for a while, and then when they molt, they turn into this thing. No pupal stage in between, no cocoon in between. The mouth parts that they use are a straw rather than jaws that they stick into a plant and suck the juices. In particular, they stick it into the xylem of the plant rather than the phloem. And xylem juice is really dilute. The phloem juice is also fairly dilute, but the phloem carries the sugars that are made by photosynthesis in the leaves, so it's at least rich in carbohydrates, but it's poor in amino acids, proteins, minerals that they need. The xylem is even worse. This is the watery stuff that's coming up from the ground, usually, rather than from the leaves. So they have to filter prodigious amounts of this fluid to get the goodies that they need to grow, and they pump it out of the vascular system of the plant, and they have a big pump on the front of their face here, and you can see it on the front of the nymph there, that works a chamber inside the head, right, sort of just behind the mouth, that moves that fluid through so they can get the stuff that they need. All right, so here's their life cycle. And with this particular example, it's the 17 years. We'll start up here. You know, they've got three stages where there's an egg here. There's a couple of them here. These things, you can see the embryo is this little dark eye spot that's in there. They hatch and burrow in the ground. Doesn't take them very long. As soon as they hit the surface of the ground, they'll burrow in and get onto a root in a few minutes. And that's the first nymphal stage. They go through several molts and each time getting bigger and bigger. After about 8 years or so, wing pads start to develop. So there's no wing pads that are evident on these young guys, but they're going to have wings as an adult, just like most insects. And rather than building them in the pupal stage, say the way that flies or bees or butterflies do, they build them externally as they're growing. Now, they can't flap them, but you can see the wing pads, you know, front wing, hind wing, as they're molting. Finally, they emerge from the ground and molt into an adult. The adults mate, and the females lay eggs. We'll talk much more about that, and then starts the cycle over. So the partitioning of it, this is a little bit misleading here with 1, 2, and 3. So they're eggs for a couple months. You know, they'll get laid, but then they're going to be in the ground by the middle of summer, mid to late summer, and then 16 and a half years underground, and then they'll come up as adults 4 to 6 weeks. Okay, so if you want to think about it, the main part of their life cycle is as nymphs getting nutrients to become big. No, adults will feed, but not that much. So good so far? Yeah.
What do adults feed on if they...
Xylem.
Xylem?
Yep.
Do they get from roots?
No, from the... I mean, the xylem runs from the roots up
all
the vascular system, so...
They can pierce...
Yeah, so this guy's stuck in, yeah.
Oh, okay.
They can pierce that.
And the annuals do that in a year, or...?
Okay, so, yeah, so Carl's raising a point about the so-called annual cicadas. That, I mean, this is a big deal because these guys haven't come out since 1996. But you say, well, there's cicadas that come out every year. You know, you heard them last August. And we call those annual cicadas because they're around every year. There's one that's really common, the dog day cicada that you can hear singing on hot summer days in end of July and August. And the one thing that we know for sure is that their life cycle lasts longer than a year. But because they're staggered, some adults come out every year. And so we don't really know how long the life cycle is. Certainly none, I don't think anybody thinks that there are any cicadas that get it done in 1 year. It's just that the periodicals are noteworthy because all the members of a local population come out en masse in 1 year.
Does the cicada stay at the same root for 17 years?
The quick answer is no, they don't. That the little guys especially can feed on anything that's small. I mean, even roots of grass or annual plants, as they start to, and they'll do that right away, as they start to grow, they'll go deeper in the soil. They might be a foot down in the soil feeding, and so then they're on the roots of trees. But because they're underground, they're hard to study. And so we don't know a lot about what goes on underground. You know, how much they're moving around, that kind of stuff. All right. So they emerge, you know, at the end of this 16 and a half years. They emerge, they come, you know, for the last, I don't know, 4 or 5 years. You know, people do go out and dig them up occasionally in areas where they know that there were periodical cicadas. They'll come up and be feeding, say, within the top, like 4 to 8 inches of the ground. And then in the last summer, they'll come up and they'll make a tube that goes close to the surface, but they won't come out of that surface. You can sometimes see them down in there just waiting. They could be out there now, and they're waiting till the soil temperature gets to be about 64, 65 degrees Fahrenheit. Well, you're saying, well, why aren't they out today? It's going to be 79 today or something like that, but last night it was 40. And so they're waiting till it really is that stable and their body temperature is that stable. Then they crawl out of the hole. Sometimes there's a little turret. If any of you have been around where crayfish are, you might have seen kind of crayfish turrets that they have. It can look like that, not necessarily just a flat hole on the ground. They usually wait till late in the day to come out, probably for a couple reasons. You know, fewer predators are going to see them. And also this molting, like you'd see this molting disaster, we call it here, it's more humid in the evening, and that helps them slip out. It prevents them from drying up too fast. And the density, so here's one of these little nymphs. I'm sorry, this is a little bit out of focus, but yeah, I copped all these from the web just to tell the story better to you. But this is, the density can be like that, you know, 20 to 40 holes per square meter, and sometimes more than one cicada will come out of the hole. No, so that's not, that's an underestimate of the population density that's there. They walk to a tree or the nearest vertical structure that they see, climb up the tree, and then the nymph holds on and splits the skin down the back. There's a hormonal cascade that regulates all that. And the new adult kind of slips out of the skin. And one cool thing that you might not have noticed, and I think you can see it in some of those skins there, these white things here, anybody know what those are? Anybody know how bugs breathe? Do they have red blood cells that carry oxygen?
No,
they don't. They have a set of tubes that runs directly from the outside. So spiracles, each body segment has a hole that's a spiracle, and there's a trachea that runs from that into the body. It's kind of like vacuum cleaner hose that, you know, it's got a little helical winding so that you can't compress it, but it's still flexible and can move around. And that tube branches get smaller, 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 goes to every cell in the body so that oxygen goes directly from the outside of the body through that system of tubes to every cell. It's really efficient. And so they don't carry oxygen in their blood. But the exo...
When they're underground, are they breathing in this?
Yeah, so there's soil interstices, but again, I don't know what happens when, say, the ground gets waterlogged. I mean, we see the worms coming up like crazy when it rains, and I don't know what these guys do. Nobody knows what these guys do.
I'm wondering what the difficulty is with studying them when they're underground, since the density is so great. Can't you kind of like guess where they are, go take a sample?
Yeah, so people have done that and dug things up, but then, okay, so you find, you know, half a dozen of them there hanging on as part of a root of a tree that you've exposed. But then they're hanging out in the air. You don't know if they were there yesterday or not. You know, and if you take them off, fill it back in with dirt and start it out at the top, you know, how do you see where it goes? And there are some techniques. We've got somebody up at the Cornell Agriculture Experiment Station in Geneva who studies grubs, so scarab beetle larvae, that are pests in turf grass, golf courses especially. And he's got a sliver kind of a arrangement about this wide, this tall by that tall, that he can x-ray through there. And so it's filled with dirt and he's got turf on top, but he can see them moving up and down in there. But that's a small little thing. With these cicadas that are on tree roots, you couldn't build quite that apparatus. Yeah.
How do they manage to pull their legs and, you know, yeah, all the carapace so, like that?
Hey, there we go. So they build this new cuticle underneath the old cuticle and have a little slightly protective coating on it and then secrete enzymes that digest the underneath of the old cuticle. The new cuticle is protected from that digestion because it has this protective outer layer that they secrete first. But that allows this, what we call molting fluid, to be in there and kind of greases the slipping out. But it's still really dangerous that they can lose a leg if it's a creature with long antennae. You know, these are pretty short, but they can get an antenna stuck and it'll break off. But they're at least not got their whole body stuck in like this guy does. These things, the exoskeleton is continuous on the body, but it also lines all those tracheal breathing tubes. So when they molt, they have to shed the insides of all those tubes. So it's like taking your clothes off and taking the inside of your lungs out at the same time. And so as he's pulling out, these are the tubes that are still stuck in the body wall here, and they're just pulling out of the main tracheal trunks. All right, so they hang there for a while, inflate the wings because they were packed up and crumpled in these wing pads here, and so they can pump blood out into the wings to get them inflated before they dry. You know, it's only two layers of cells, so after they get all inflated, the two layers adhere to each other, and that makes a nice sort of a stiff membrane like this, and it can take a bunch of hours till it gets like that. He's still not completely hard. With insects, kind of a good rule of thumb is that the darker they are, the harder the cuticle is. And so he'll tan up. I mean, you saw the picture of him at the start. He's got his eyes going. I actually don't know what these two black spots are, but they're characteristic of the periodical cicadas when they first come out. But then the whole body will darken up. He'll be able to fly away. They still won't make noise for maybe another week or so. And I'll talk about the noisemaker. So how do they count to 17? No, this is a thing. It's critical first that they do, because if they come out, you know, if some of them come out in 16 years or some of them come out in 18 years, there's not going to be enough of them out to satiate the predators. So they'll all get eaten. They have no other defenses than just swamping hungry predators. So Rick Carbon out at UC Davis did this experiment. It's a really low budget, tedious experiment, which is that he got some pear trees and put them in pots and said, all right, I'm going to wait and watch this pot. You know, it had cicada nymphs in there. I'm going to watch this pot and see when they come out. You know, see if they really count to 17. But what he did, so here's just the normal emergence one. These are light levels in this greenhouse where he worked, you know, hours per day of light. And so here's a year, and in the summertime there's more light, and then it comes down. You know, so these are the yearly cycles. Broken here, you know, first year, and then broken, and we'll get the last part that's the interesting part. For this experimental group in the bottom, he took a variety of pears that is capable of flowering twice a year if you fool it with the light cycle. So you shorten its day and then make its day longer again. It doesn't know that only 6 months have gone by. So the pear starts to, you know, so he added cicadas to the one that was normal as a control just for moving cicada nymphs around, added the others to the one that he was going to shorten the day length. And so now he's getting double duty on the flowering cycles. And most of the cicadas are coming out early. They're accelerated because he accelerated the flowering cycle of this tree. So it's not that the cicadas actually count to 17 independent on their own, or that they count hot versus cold, or they add up, you know, integrate all the thermal days. They're letting the plant figure out the seasons, and they're somehow counting the flowering times of the plant. So they could be tied into plant hormone flushes or something like that. They still have to have someplace stored in their brain 17. You know, we're adding one. Okay, we just had another one. Is it enough yet? You know, so somehow we don't have no idea how they do that. But we know that they're not counting it on their own. It's related to the cycling of the host plant.
What is this guy's name?
Rick Carbon, K-A-R-B-A-N.
Okay, how long has he been studying this?
Oh, a long time. But this was like, he's been a periodical cicada guy for a long time.
Is there a personality trait for people who study 17-year cicadas?
I met a bunch of them. No, I wouldn't say more so than...
people see the really big picture like astrophysicists.
No, because it's a cool thing, you know, but you don't have to wait 17 years to get data. They're somewhere in the U.S., and we'll get to that slide. There's cicadas, periodical cicadas, that come out almost every summer. So there's a group of people that, and it is kind of, so in one sense, I'd say it's a little more collegial because they can't study them at their home institution except maybe once in 17 years when, you know, if they happen to live in a place where there's an emergence. But they go descend on the place where the brood is, and often, so I first met these folks in grad school in the early 80s when the brood in Kansas, that's where I went, University of Kansas, when that brood was emerging, and they came from all over the world to Lawrence, Kansas to set up shop for the summer, and people were giving them space in their lab. There were some acoustic guys there and some ecologists there. And, you know, they had a little symposium on what they'd learned that summer. So they all worked together. And a couple of them even ended up getting married, Monty Lloyd and Joanne White, because they kept meeting in the summer at these different places around. So in that sense, there's maybe a little bit more collegiality among the group than, say, people who happen to study garter snakes.
How big is the group of cicada experts?
Not many, actually now. There's a lot of folks who kind of do one-offs or not their main project, like me, but the main folks there might be eight people that do it all the time.
Eight people, yeah. In the U.S.
Yeah. Yeah, because this is the only place where they are. They're not other parts of the world that are like this.
Why is that?
We don't know. You know? And as I say, even the annual cicadas probably have a life cycle longer than 1 year. And so in a sense, they're periodical. It's just each population keeps their own count, and it's not so noticeable as the way it is with these guys.
Can you say the only place, do you mean North America?
I'll show you, Eastern North America.
Is there any other kind of insect or animal that does this kind of like swarm technique? That like they're only because they're delicious, aren't they, for pretty much every animal?
Well, okay, false premise. A lot of creatures eat them. I'm not sure I would say they're delicious. I've tasted them. They taste like bugs as far as that goes. You know, they're crunchy and depends on what you saute them with. In terms of So there's a lot of other kind of mass emergences. You know, mayflies often, I mean, there's wild pictures up along Lake Erie and Lake Ontario of mayfly emergences where they're, the dead bodies are piled up this high under the streetlights. I mean, it's just, they're huge emergences. Salmon running, I've seen a couple places in Alaska up there where, you know, the bears are getting full on salmon. So that could be a little bit of predator satiation. The wildebeest in Africa, you know, they drop their young within like a 3-day period. And there's only so many young wildebeest that a lion or a hyena can eat. And the rest of them are able to run and move along with the herd.
So sorry, can I just clarify? So Eastern North America, that's
the I'll show you a map.
Okay.
Yeah. Actually, I'll subject you to several maps. Okay, so after about a week, when they're firmed up, they're fully dark, the guys will start calling. Girls don't call, okay? The guys will call, and they'll get together in aggregations. And so, you know, this is like nothing, but I wanted to illustrate that just they're hanging around. They're all over. If you're in one of these places, you will have no trouble finding them or hearing them. I mean, if you can drive around with your windows open and hear them calling, and if they're not bouncing into your car, you're not quite close enough yet, but then you'll get there and find them, okay? So what they call with, most of you might be familiar sort of with crickets or rubbing one wing against the other, or grasshoppers rub their leg against their wing to make it. These guys do it differently. Yeah, okay, I'm sorry that didn't show up on this projector. They have an organ called the timbal, and it's exoskeleton, so it's made of chitin. It has a series of ribs in there, and you can see it on these two spread wing guys in here. And here's a picture of it. There's a big fat muscle on the back of it, and then the rest of the abdomen is hollow, so it's a big resonator. And I don't think we have a... See if I can, I'm gonna sneak through here. I know, trouble for the cameraman. If we've got something that I can't quite see if I can make a makeshift. No, it's not gonna do it. So this muscle pulls on this set of ribs here, and they buckle in, and as each one buckles, it makes a little popping sound. So they pull on it, goes pop, 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 and then they let the muscle go pop, 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 okay? And so here's a, you know, slice it there and look in from the back, these big timbal muscles, and there's the sound. So the buckle in, you know, pop, 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 and then the relaxation is softer. But the cool thing about it is that it's like this set of ribs and the timbal is like a spring. So they pull it in with the muscle and it pops. Now it has stored energy in that spring, so it can go really fast. It's one of the fastest muscles known. It can contract lots faster than we can do that. I mean, we're talking maybe up to 1,000 times a second this thing can contract.
How does that compare to a bumblebee's wingbeat?
Oh, they're... I can't tell you what a bumblebee is, but I'm going to guess 150-ish.
This is an order of magnitude higher.
Yeah. And so, but bumblebees actually have an aside about muscle, have a kind of muscle that only contracts when a nerve says contract. That's the way all our muscles are, the way you think of a standard muscle. This kind of muscle is what we call stretch activated, so that when the timbal pulls out, that energy that's stored in the spring pulls out, it stretches that muscle. It doesn't need a nerve to activate it then, just the stretching will cause it to contract again. And so those muscles can go much faster. So the wings of flies, actually, are all stretch-activated. And so they can fly at a higher wing beat frequency than having to send a nerve signal there all the time.
And you said 1,000 times per...
second.
That is unbelievable.
Yeah. Okay, so it's making the sound. I think this is where I was going to play sound for you. So there's several different... species. Well, there's seven in total. Some of them are hard to distinguish from one another. There's 3 17-year variety and there's 4 13-year variety. The easiest thing to think of is with the 17s that you'll have here, there's a big one that has a lower frequency and a different form to its sound. You'll hear that. And then there's a little one that has a higher frequency and a different form to its sound. So I'll play the big one first. Let's see if you can hear it. There he's going. So kind of just... And then... And so it's when you're out in them, amongst them, so that was like a single individual. And what happens is that for the big guy that's this low frequency, kind of, it goes on all the time because the nearby guys wait and they hear him turning off and then they jump on and start their signal. So it's more continuous. The little guys, they hear somebody else start and they jump in and get in on the start. So it's more like a ee-ew, and then they all get quiet for just a moment. But they're jumping in on the start rather than on the finish of one of these other guys. So here's one of the little guys. Higher frequency. I don't know what that's about. The stuff you find on the web that you can't trust. Okay, so that was him being high. Sometimes they do that little ticking to warm up, and then they all jump on. I think there's another one on here. Okay. You get the idea, and you will soon enough hear them. But just and down here, there are some places where you have both species. There's a third species that's in the middle that has a slightly different sound that is never very abundant wherever it is compared to the big one and the little one, and so I wasn't going to bother you with those guys.
So one brood can have both?
You will have both in the same woods down here. Some places I know historically that's been the case, and if you look on the cicada database you can see that
the female doesn't have the timbal.
No, the girls don't make any sound. They do make a little bit of sound that I'll show you, but not with that timbal. They can flick their wings and make a sound. And that's the case, that's the case with grasshoppers and most crickets as well, is that I like to say the guys talk and the girls walk. So he makes a sound, and if she is interested, she'll go over. He has no idea that she's even coming up until she touches him. No, because they're crickets especially, they're doing it in the dark, you know, calling, and he's just out there calling, and eventually somebody comes or they don't.
What makes a successful cicada? Is he the loudest?
No. Oh.
Because for crickets.
So I'm going to, let me see if we got a, yeah. Mr. Good Enough is what she seems to be looking for. That it's, so in, you know, your first thought when you think about this, oh, all the guys are getting together in this aggregation and calling, that sounds like a lek. That sounds like rough grouse, you know, that are out. Everybody's doing his booming thing, or prairie chickens, or that sort of thing. And the girls come and they look around, they sample, you know, or Birds of Paradise kind of thing. There's some great new movies from Cornell out on that. Doesn't seem like the girls do that. They come into the aggregation, they hang around for a little while. If they'll listen to a guy, and if they like the guy, they'll flick their wings. It makes an audible sound that he can hear. He might even be able to see it too, but they'll flick their wings, and he'll hop over a little closer to her, call again. She flicks her wings again. They'll mate, and she's out of there. You know, she mates once. That's it. And the guys within the aggregation, if they're calling, they'll call a little bit, call a couple of times, and if they don't get lucky, they'll go to another branch and call again. So we don't think that the girls are really doing any kind of sexual selection or choosing like the loudest guy, because I mean that would depend on how far away she is from him as well, you know, or certain frequency. It has to be within a particular frequency band, but it seems like she's not putting a lot of thought into this. And then she'll go away, so they mate, you know, end to end. She'll go away and lay eggs. She's got an egg tube that she stabs into twigs out at the ends of branches and makes a slit. And you can see here some of the slits that are open, little egg nests. She'll put in 20 to 30 per set of twigs, or, you know, per set of nests. And she might have, people have counted them in lab colonies, Joanne White did this, between, you know, 180 and 200 per female. Okay, so kind of low for a bug in some respects. Okay, so.
Any type of tree plant preferences?
A wide range, hardwoods mostly, oaks, elms, hickories, but fruit trees as well. We'll get onto that when we talk about their effects on people. So here's what I was saying about where the periodical cicadas live. These are all the different broods put together. So kind of from the 100th meridian over to the coast, where, you know, so there's our Finger Lakes brood here. It's almost the northernmost. The tip of brood two is up here. So these are like at the top of the range up here of all of these things. And this is composed of the 17 years and the 13 year broods. So I'll show you the next slide is going to be little individual maps of these broods. So, you know, here's brood one through, what are we up to, 14 there. So seven is the Finger Lakes there. Here's brood two. I'll show you a close-up in the next image. But kind of down the eastern seaboard, when this image was made, I think the population here in Georgia just barely indicated there. The 17-year ones, if you look and kind of do a rough, you know, squint-eye integration, they're mostly in the northern part of this eastern half of the U.S., whereas the 13s are more in the southern part.
So this year it's from this region roughly down to
North Carolina, and there's probably, there are in 96, there are two populations in Georgia were found. How big they are isn't clear. And if they're, you know, if they're stragglers, I already mentioned stragglers in time that come out in the wrong year, but stragglers in space that get separated from the rest are in danger of not having a big enough population to swamp the predators. You know, there's been estimates that it has to be maybe, you know, 3,000 or 4,000 individuals per acre to swamp predators to get anybody through. But at that, okay, so let's say 1,000 get through, how many are going to make it then 17 years from then? We know very little about the underground mortality.
So it's a sort of I-95 brood from...
Yeah.
Is this brood unique in any respects?
No.
Is it?
Oh, yes. I would say because it's unique in the respect that it encompasses the two biggest media centers that we have in the United States, New York and Washington, D.C. Brood 10 only is Washington, D.C. But other than that, no. It is big in terms of geography, but this one that's kind of up the Mississippi Valley, and this one here is larger spatially.
You don't get any of these 17-year or 13-year periodical ones in other countries?
No.
Just the U.S.?
Right here. Good old U.S. of A.
If these are big and noisy and helpless, how do the annuals ever survive?
They're camouflaged.
Which the periodicals aren't.
Black with bright red eyes?
Okay.
No, it's actually...
Oh, so the very distinct in appearance.
Yes.
Okay.
Yeah. So, yeah, I guess I should have put a couple of regulars in there. I'm sorry. In fact... They're so contrasty. Most things in the world that are animals in the world that are black and red are saying, "Don't touch me because I will make you sick or I will kill you." You know, and it's surprising. And you know, maybe these guys are trying to play that game, but it doesn't seem to work. There's nothing that anybody has demonstrated, no other creature that they're actually mimicking that would be the poisonous model, so called.
So
whereas the regular ones,
are bright green, right?
There are some. There's one in Australia called the greengrocer that is, you know, bright green. Ours are, they're greenish, but there's black on them. There's a little bit of dark brown on them. So they're much more mottled, and not in such great density. No, the guys still call in the daytime. You know, you can go out and hear them, but you have to search pretty hard to find one.
In fossil terms, when did an insect with this sort of habit appear on the Earth?
So Chris Simon just had a paper come out in the last month. I think Sato is the first author. There just happens to be a copy of it here. Proceedings of the National Academy of Science. It's the first molecular study of these cicadas and looking at who's really related to who. And as it turns out, all the 17-year ones are not related to one another. Each 17-year is related to one 13-year cicada, okay? And that was known before just from looking at them. But they ran a molecular clock on the genes that they did and come up with the divergence of them, of the three main species groups about 4 million years ago. You know, and just... the reason that I haven't made a big point of showing you the different species is because you wouldn't be able to tell. I can't tell, other than if I have two in the hand, I can say, okay, here's the big one and here's the little one. And just to put that into perspective, humans diverged from chimps about 6 million years ago. So we've got that much difference going on. These cicadas are almost that different in terms of their genes, but not in terms of just the phenotype, what they look like on the outside.
And who were their progenitors?
Oh, plenty of other cicadas. In this, I forget who they actually had, what cicadas they had as an outgroup. So that's just like the nearest close relative that you use to help you understand the tree that you're working on. But it's some other cicadas. But I don't know if there's a good phylogeny for all the cicadas to show where these guys are placed. I mean, it's known what subfamily they're in. All the cicadas are considered one family, and then there's a bunch of different subfamilies. All right, so what you can see, though, is that on this, almost every summer, somebody's going to come out. You know, we're missing 2022, And in some summers, for instance, 2024, 17 and a 13 is going to come out. And in fact, you know, kind of up here in the border states, they might even overlap with one another. So this is a clue for the folks who are trying to figure out when the respective 17 and 13 actually did diverge. What do we got? So here's a closer up view of brood two, you know, where it occurs down to here. As I say, there's a couple more that were found. This was, I think, done in 1988. There's a couple more that were found in 96 down here, but I don't think they're very big populations. Yeah. So here we go. The first guy that figured this out, so back in the 1800s, there was an entomologist, C.V. Riley, who was one of the top entomology guy in the around the Civil War, and he's got this great handlebar mustache, and he was all over in the Midwest kind of describing these things, saying, oh, whoa, there's a population out here that's just in Iowa that does that same thing, you know, that he saw back in the East. But it wasn't until around 1900 that an entomologist working for the USDA, a guy named Charles Marlatt, just decided, all right, collate all that data, look and see when those different spatial groups were reported, and realized that they weren't overlapping, and he was the one that started the brood numbering system and really set up this way that we count it now. And so that's what historical means here. He published his first thing in 1907, but then he put out a more accessible book in 1923. And so he said that in the same sync with brood two, when they come out, that there were some coming out here over in Michigan, Indiana, on the border here, that might, you know, way back in the day historically have been part of this brood, but somehow had been fragmented by the time he was counting. And then Chris Simon started working on it and put out kind of went through some of his records, went down to the Smithsonian, looked at some of his specimens and trimmed it up a little bit. And then here's the cicada database that she runs that has this as the map for the brood.
And the question of who among the cicadas said, 13 years, it's working pretty well.
Yeah, this four-year acceleration.
Let's try 17.
And why?
What pioneer?
Why each of the three main species groups also hit on a 14-year acceleration? That's bizarre. Nobody has an idea. Yeah. Okay, so for New York, for brood two, these are the counties that I know that either I've seen specimens or are on the database, or there's an old record. Yeah, they're probably in Rensselaer County. They're probably in Westchester and Putnam, but I can't find any record of it. And I didn't go dig through all the newspapers or anything like that. So maybe, you know, I'm sure somebody from Westchester would have described them, but anyway. So yeah, Long Island, Staten Island. So you should probably see them down here and further on down.
So if you hate the noise, you should move west.
Well, no, if you hate the noise, you should look at this and try to figure out where to move. You know, if you moved west to Syracuse, like
No, west to Colorado.
Out here, yeah. You're good. Yeah.
Are they moving west?
No. No, there's a lot of plants and animals that have this 100th meridian as a dividing line, that the prairie is just too tough to get across. This is like the farthest western extent of the eastern deciduous forest. And then it turns into tall grass prairie here. And then the grass gets shorter and shorter and shorter as you go to the Front Range. And so there's a lot of stuff that divides down that line.
What was the name of that line?
Oh, the 100th meridian. So the meridians are the longitudes. And, you know, you guys got Greenwich, that's zero, and you get to 100 by the time you're around our Midwest.
Do Do you have any idea of the numbers we're talking about of insects? And also, where will it be most spectacular? Are there any cities where they're not going to be really obvious within the city limits, like downtown?
Yeah, I can't tell you that, unfortunately. I will leave it on this one. No. Yeah, here. That, I mean, I just, before you guys came, I was talking with somebody from Albany, and historically they've been there. I don't know if they were there in 1996, but, and she didn't know either. So, you know, there's a city, it could potentially be that. But I can't tell you if that's, so where I'm going
to
go.
It might vary from 17 year to 17 year.
Yeah, to the next 17 years, depending on what has happened. So I'm going to go. So we're, you know, wherever Tompkins County is. So Ithaca's there, and I'm going to go to Ulster County with some students. The Ulster County Fairgrounds, I know, will have them, or they should, because in 1996, the guy who was the collection manager of our research collection at Cornell went there and collected a big series of them. The population should be healthy. It's a, you know, it's a place I know. It's public property. It's not going into somebody's yard. And so I'm going to wait till early June. I don't want to be there the first day, because you can't predict when the first day is. You know, when I was living with postdocing and we moved to Bloomington, Indiana, I was postdocing at IU, and turned out a cicada year, and like there was a lot of them in the forest around there. I don't know how many of you have ever been to Bloomington, but it's fairly rural. But like our yard was just holes from cicadas. Our front yard, we had them coming up. You know, it was intense. You didn't have to, I mean, it was annoying in the daytime is what it was.
Do you have any idea like the total number?
The numbers, yeah. So for this brood, I'm sure it could be in the billions, maybe even more. That the kind of the two of us, I was mentioning this to somebody before, I can't remember who, the sort of the two grand old guys of periodical cicadas, Henry Divis and Monty Lloyd, back when I was in grad school, they estimated an area in Illinois that they had 1.5 million per acre in that area. So yeah, per acre. And that's kind of held up as, and both those guys were good scientists. I mean, yeah, it's an estimation. They didn't count them all, I'm sure. But they're trustworthy because they were seasoned cicada researchers. And so everybody kind of holds that up as, well, they could be this many if it's really, you know, a huge aggregation. And the total down the eastern seaboard, easy.
What's the difference between a cicada? I'm sorry, go ahead.
I was just wondering, is there anything that you have to wait every 17 years to study? Is there something particular that you look for only when they emerge?
No, I mean, like I said, there's this group of cicada researchers that every year they're doing it. In terms of studying one in the same population, the interesting questions really are now range decline. That, I mean, why, if you just want to know more about their biology, their mating system, sound production, you can go anywhere and study them. But if you're interested in why are they declining, then you want to study the same one intensively.
What if, like, you go back to like the difficult plague of locusts, what's a locust compared to a cicada?
So a locust is a grasshopper, and so that's it shares with the cicada that it doesn't have a pupa, that it molts several times as a nymph, and then it develops its wings on the outside. They keep getting longer and longer and longer until the final stage when it molts into an adult. It has full wings and it has genitalia, so it's reproductively mature. The cicada is a little bit different because it's under the ground and doesn't quite look like the adult, but looks pretty similar. That face shot that I showed you was sort of similar. So, and the locust, there's the biblical plague locusts are still in Africa flying around, you know, terrorizing the folks there. There's also plague and the Arabian Peninsula. There's plague locusts in Australia now still. We used to have one in the United States, the Rocky Mountain locust, Melanopus spiratus. And as far as I know, that's the only insect that humans have ever driven extinct on purpose. And there's a great book by Jeffrey Lockwood, I think just called Locusts. He's out in Montana or Idaho somewhere. And it was a combination of things, but they used to swarm up out of Mexico, across the Great Plains, the Basin and Range. That was the, those were the insects that were plaguing the Mormons when they got to Salt Lake, and the gulls came and ate them, and that's why there's a big statue of a seagull in Salt Lake City now, because it saved them, because they were thinking, oh, biblical, you know, the locusts. And people found where their egg-laying grounds were and plowed them up. They also were using the primitive insecticides at the time, the copper and arsenic-based insecticides that were being used. And there was also a couple of bad seasons. And so it wasn't that humans did it all, but they were really trying to get rid of them as the West was being settled in the mid-1800s. And now they're gone. You know, they exist no more, except in some glaciers where they were flying around and they got high up and they got stuck in the glacial ice. And so Lockwood's playing around with this idea of, you know, their DNA is in there. And it might be interesting to know what makes those melanoplast species swarmy and plaguey, whereas we have other members of that genus, the red-legged grasshopper, melanoplast ferrum rubrum, that's around here, and they never get plaguey. And so what, you know, that might be an interesting question.
Plaguey means a big swarm?
Yeah, that they get in a, well, they group together, from generally grasshoppers like to be solitary, but when they get plaguey, they turn gregarious. And so then they're hanging together. And so it's a real behavioral change. Their colors change. They have a different, slightly different morphology when they go through this plaguey aspect. The other thing that I was going to say is that, so the reason that these things, even though they're very different in terms of what they eat, what they look like, their biology, they're sometimes called 17-year locusts, and that's because the pilgrims, when they came and landed on Cape Cod, you know, they barely survived out there. They got off the Cape onto the mainland, and cicadas came out, periodical cicadas. And they were thinking, oh, my God, you know, what do we do to deserve this? And the only bugs that they knew that came in big numbers like that were from the Bible.
So they called them locusts.
They called them locusts, and because I don't think they...
Would that have been in the 1600s?
Yeah, 1628, 27. I forget the exact year that they landed. And I don't think they probably had any entomologists among their group that could explain, no, sucking mouth parts versus mandibles.
So again, about this map then.
Yeah.
So at the moment, you don't expect to see them in Manhattan?
I don't know. I haven't. So I've gotten I got a call from one of the production manager for a Spike Lee film that's going to be made here this summer. And they're saying, could this affect our sound recording? I said, "What? Indeed it will if they're here." But they wanted really local information. And Central Park could be okay for cicadas, but I don't know. So I directed them to the American Museum of Natural History. They should probably have a cicada hotline there that's very, very local. So I don't know. I found no records of them from Manhattan, but you know, people could see them and not tell anybody who keeps track of these things.
How far do they travel from, like, the tree that they mate on?
Not very far. They're poor flyers. And kind of the record, so that's one of the things I want to go look at this summer, is to see how far they do fly, and if you release them away from a chorus, can they fly in that direction? How loud does it have to be? But if you just stand at the edges of woods and watch how far out they might fly, a couple hundred meters is all that you see. I mean, they're not going, you know, I mean, like the plague locust, they're swarming hundreds of kilometers.
Right, so you won't see any flying over from the Palisades into Manhattan or anything like that. They have to be
probably
in
Central
Park.
Yeah.
And
if you did, there'd be a bird chasing it.
Would there be any occasion where they'll like fill the skies? Like
locusts? No, not like locusts or starlings.
So the spectacle will be seeing them
in the woods or at the edge, more so at the edge of the woods, that they like the margin, not just deep in. The little one likes more lowland forest, so more slightly wetter area. But yeah, standing at the edge, they will be all flying around, like I say, bumping into you and loud.
And what's on their little minds? Mating? They're not worried about
and
getting
mating,
really.
And mating, and mating, if it's a guy, I mean, come on. And if it's the females mate once and oviposit. Get your eggs in the twig, because that's, you waited 17 years for that. The guys will multiply mate. They will try to mate with as many girls as they can. I mean, that's, they're guys.
So they're not doing anything actively to avoid things?
No, well, so very little. That there's some evidence. You can just walk up to a tree and pick them up in a way that you can't do that with the annual cicadas. The guys will sometimes give a little buzz with their timbal and fly off. And there's some evidence that that can startle some kinds of predators and buy them, you know, 200 milliseconds, and that's enough that they can get away. The girls can't do that, and they're lots easier to catch. That really, it does seem like it's all about predator satiation.
Yeah. So if there's a group of them in one particular forest, they're not going to move further away. They'll basically be flying around that one.
That's what we think. That's what it looks like, and that's one of the reasons why I want to kind of do this release from different distances away to see, well, what happens if their forest got cut down. If there were more forest that was a quarter mile away, could they go over there, and would it be okay, or are they really restricted to the plots that historically they've been in? And if we take those away, then they're done, even if there's more forest someplace else, because they don't seem like they're great flyers. All right, so what good are they? At least in their ecosystem, they do some good. For one, everybody eats cicadas when they come out. That all the omnivorous creatures will eat them because they're easy to catch. No, the guys, I mean, they don't have much in the abdomen. They've got the big timbal muscles, but the rest of it is a resonating cavity. But they have flight muscles in the thorax, and so they'll eat them. Even other, you know, so foxes and raccoons, but even squirrels that are, you know, you think of them as acorn eaters, they will bite these things and eat them. Bugs, you know, here's a picture of some ants working on one of these guys. When we lived in Bloomington and we're watching them, you know, slip out of the nymphal skin right in our front yard, I saw lots of cases of predatory ants that were just, oh, too helpful. Let me help you get out of that skin. And just biting this thing, stinging it, and, you know, feeding on it. They'll cut it up into pieces and take it back to the nest. Here's a cool picture, just because I like spiders. My wife studies spiders, a jumping spider that's wrestled one of these things down. But the primary predator on them is birds, and there's good data, pretty good data, let's say, for birds that have their nesting time during the cicada flush, that they, in a cicada year, so red-winged blackbirds is one that there's data for, also eastern bluebird, for that they can fledge more young and that the young will be bigger in a cicada year. And so it's a boost to the local economy, you know, the food chain, if you will, when there's cicadas to be eaten. Shrews also get bigger and switch over and feed on cicadas. The other thing that's cool is that there's all these dead bodies. So all these nymphal skins that get shed, and then the adults eventually die and they fall in the forest. Well, chitin, the polymer that makes up their exoskeleton, it's a carbohydrate, but it has a lot of nitrogen in it. And so they're essentially making a nitrogen fertilizer pulse over this several-week period that falls on the ground. Well, does that do anything? It does. Yeah, I'm making you look at a data slide. I'm sorry. But just, you know, so both nitrate and ammonia in the soil goes up the more dead cicadas you have. So this is work from Louis Yang He was an undergrad at Cornell, and now he's on the faculty at UC Davis. And Louis went out and collected 20,000 cicadas, and so he could do controlled experiments. We're, you know, putting known numbers out of dead ones and measuring. So nitrogen goes up in the soil, and he didn't do anything with trees, but he measured this flower that's like a woodland little flower. And so nitrogen in the leaves, there's the control. 10 cicadas is all he added to the pots, and he's got more nitrogen showing up in the leaves, and the seeds are bigger. So they're going to be more successful, this plant, just from getting some cicadas. So think of this as the adult cicadas, and these kinds of plants are the sorts of things that the first instar or the first stage nymph is feeding on as soon as it falls on the ground. So it's the parents are fertilizing the woods for their own kids that are going to be in there. So that part's pretty cool. I like that.
Of course, the deer is going to come eat that plant.
Yes, they will. And other things will too. And that was a secondary thing that he found, was that the leaves that have more nitrogen, more herbivores also will bite them. So from the plant's point of view, yeah, the cicadas are okay, maybe, but because it gets bigger seeds, but its leaves are getting bit more.